brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Softweb Radio, special operations military news, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hey, what's going on? This is Rad, your host of Soft Rep Radio, and I have a great episode today. You hear me say it day in and day out, so let me get right to it. Softrep.com/the merch store. Go check out the merch store. We really appreciate you guys picking up the branded merchandise for Soft Rep, Soft Rep Radio. Go check it out. It keeps the fireplace going. I'm really grateful for all the tags on the internet with the merch. Second, we have a book club. It is softrep.com/book-club. And we talk to a lot of authors here at Soft Rep, and we get a lot of their books into our library so that you guys can choose them while you're out and about. So join the library, the book club at softrep.com/book-club. And right now, Soft Rep is having great deals on its membership. So I've just got to plug Soft Rep, Soft Rep, Soft Rep, and you're already here. Now, without further ado, my next guest is an author who has written a book called Super Bowl Monday, which talks about, you know, going from the Persian Gulf to Miami for the Super Bowl Monday, which is what the book is called. But today's book that we're going to talk about is The Wingman. And so I wanted to bring you up with the Super Bowl Monday book, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, Adam Lazarus, the author.
That's right, yeah.
So far, so good, right? So to preface it, you wrote Super Bowl Monday, and then now you've come out with The Wingman, which is what we're going to talk about. And The Wingman follows, history, really. You know, first of all, baseball season's upon us. It's springtime, and we're going to be seeing baseball players. And Ted Williams was a major baseball player throughout the early days of the history of baseball. And then you have John Glenn. Two unlikely individuals who have become friends. You have an astronaut, Marine Corps pilot, multiple MiGs shot down during World War II. John Glenn went up in space again in 1996 or 98 at 77 years old, I think. You know, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. So am I right so far on everything I've said?
A couple minor things, very minor.
Fix me.
The Super Bowl Monday book was about sort of the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War, and it was about the Super Bowl played in Tampa, so not Miami, but Florida-ish. And about John Glenn, he did shoot down three Soviet MiGs during the Korean War. But he was also a very highly decorated World War II pilot in the Pacific for a Marine Corps squadron. But yeah, it's a book about two men who really had virtually completely opposite backgrounds and worldviews and outlooks on everything from marriage to politics to religion to family events, and lived completely different lives from the day they were, you know, could learn to walk to the day they died. But they had this friendship that developed during the Korean War. They served together for about 5 months during the Korean War, towards the end of the Korean War, 1953. And it's an interesting story. That's how they met. That's sort of how they got to know one another. But their friendship persisted for many decades after that.
So those two were both serving and they both became friends. So Ted Williams is a Marine?
Yes.
Wow. Semper Fi. Okay.
He comes around at a time that's very hard for probably modern people, like even people you're my age, but even like, especially like my kids, like thought all these major athletes and not just athletes, but like movie actors and everyone going to World War II, obviously got into, for the most part, if you could walk and were a man between the ages of like 18 and 30, you went into service during World War II. And that's how Ted Williams first got into the Marines. He was actually a Navy flight instructed cadets at a Naval Air Station during World War II. He didn't serve in combat, but he stayed in something called, I don't even know if they still have it, the Volunteer Reserves, which meant you could basically stay in the reserves for the Marines in perpetuity. You didn't have to do any training, requalification or anything. You just kept your Marine Corps rank. In fact, oftentimes you got small promotions and you didn't have to do anything. And people liked that. They liked, like Ted Williams liked being called captain when he wasn't, even though he wasn't flying a plane. But it meant that if another war broke out, there was a chance you could be recalled. And he stayed in, not thinking there was a chance that first there would be any other kind of war, but then when the Korean War breaks out, even that he didn't think was going to lead to him being recalled. And it turns out he was wrong, and he was recalled to service in the Marines during the Korean War.
And so what did he take? What did he do in the Korean War? What was it? What was Ted's, you know, they pulled him in. He's like, hey, I'm Ted Williams.
He was not happy about being recalled. He didn't like that he had missed 3 years during World War II, but everybody missed during World War II. And he was older. He had a daughter that he was married with, a daughter at this time. He was the highest paid player in professional baseball, which for the most part really meant he was the highest paid athlete in America. Mm-hmm. And nobody else was really being not many people were being recalled. It was later in the war. The Korean War wasn't the same as like America after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. He wasn't happy about it, and he did what he could get out of it. Once it was clear that he was going to go serve, he did his duty, and he went over to a small Marine Corps base in the southeastern tip of the Korean Peninsula. And 6 days later, John Glenn arrived at the same base in the same squadron, and that's how they met. Very good fortune, at least for my book writing career, that they wound up in the same place at the same time with the same assignments. They went on missions together. They flew the same type of missions every day together.
Now, Ted Williams was playing baseball, right? Wasn't he an outfielder for like the Red Sox?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was, most people consider him the greatest hitter of all time. He piled up many, many records. And oftentimes they were paired together with John Glenn in the lead and Ted Williams as his wingman.
Right. And the thing is, he goes and does it. Like, he doesn't get a waiver from some professional doctor to like say, oh, you know, you got flat feet, you're not going. He didn't do any of that. He said, I got to go. My call just came. Like,
who say that Babe Ruth or some of the more modern players, but most real baseball history experts consider Ted Williams the greatest hitter of all time. And you're right. He started in 1939.
Sure.
By 1952, when he was recalled to service, he was in the middle of his career. He was only 32 years old, but he was still playing. Yeah, the year before, he had played a full season for the Red Sox, finishes the season in October of 1951. And then on January 9th, a couple months later, while he's fishing in Florida on his like break before spring training starts, he gets a memo saying, you've been recalled. So he goes, and yeah, it was the middle of his career, which is, you know, something we could never imagine today. But what I think is even more remarkable is he serves the 2 years in the Korean War, comes back and plays seven more seasons. So, yeah, it's very interesting. As I mentioned, he did do what he could to get out of service. He did not want to go back in service. It's true. He did what he could. He also, he underwent major arm injury playing baseball 2 years earlier, and he thought that that was going to lead to him being disqualified medically from his Navy exam. And it turns out it didn't happen. And they said, you're going to serve. And he says, this is in my book, and he said several years later that if he wanted a safe desk job, he could have gotten it. He could have, you know, made enough calls and lobbied the right people and been assigned maybe abroad, maybe in Korea, maybe in the United States to serve his 17 months. Because he was an officer, he had to serve at least 17 months. But he realized, for a bunch of reasons, he didn't want to do that. One of them was he loved the challenge. He loved the challenge of everything: fishing, chasing women, hunting, playing baseball. But he loved the challenge of being a pilot. And at this point, 1952, it's the beginning of the jet age, and jets had just come out, and he loved the appeal of the jet. And he had never flown the jet when he was in World War II. He only flew propeller planes, Corsair, the famous plane used during World War II. But when the Korean War breaks out and they say he has a chance to go learn how to fly jets and fly the jet over in Korea, he says, yeah, I'm game. I want to do it. So to his credit, he did his service. He never shirked out of a mission. And he flew 39 combat missions into communist North Korea across the 38th parallel with people shooting at him, dropping bombs, and he had some very interesting adventures and a couple with John Glenn and on off of his wing.
That's awesome. Did he ever get a World Series?
He went to the World Series the first year back from World War II, which was 1946. He had a great year, won the MVP, took the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series in, 28 years, and he didn't play very well and they lost. And he never got back to another World Series. It's kind of the one great regret of his life and the one sort of the lone blemish on his baseball career.
So he kind of was involved in the curse, right? That whole Boston Red Sox.
Sort of one of the early incarnations of the curse. Yes.
Yes, yes. No, I love that. Now let's flip the coin over to John Glenn, right? United States Senator for many years. Let's see, my brother was born in 74. I think John Glenn became a senator.
It was his first year, 74. 70,
yeah. 74. And then he served until like almost 2000.
74 to 9 to, yeah, to 2000. That's right. Well, 75 yeah. to 99. So yeah. But okay. yeah, he's four-term senator from the state of Ohio. Did some very important, worked on some very important bills and some treaties with the reduction of arms in the late 70s, ran for president, not have a very good presidential campaign. And that's something that's outlined thoroughly in the book, because there's a Ted Williams story in there about Ted Williams not endorsing him for president, which is a whole other story that I hope your readers, your listeners, and pick up the book and find out more about. But yeah, and then all before that, before he became a senator, astronaut, first man to orbit the Earth, was a very...
Three times,
yes. First American to orbit the Earth, three times. The third round trip around the Earth was pretty harrowing, as if anybody who's watched The Right Stuff knows. They thought there was a faulty heat shield that might incinerate his spacecraft when it re-entered Earth. But even before, you know, one of... he had a Marine Corps Navy... funeral at Arlington when he died in 2007, when he died in 2016, but in April of 2017. And one of the people there was the senator who had occupied his seat after he retired. And the chaplain was giving a long explanation of John Glenn's career, everything he did. And the senator, who was Rob Portman at the time from Ohio, said something like, "I didn't realize he was a hero even before he orbited the Earth three times." So his service in World War II, his service in Korea, his work as a test pilot, he was a remarkable individual and someone I think Americans today could really use a person like John Glenn in their government.
You know, I was thinking about that when I was getting ready to talk with you about John Glenn. I was like, where is that guy today? You know, and I know I was like, is he still alive? Did I miss that? And I didn't miss it. And I'm glad I lived through John Glenn. I was born in 1977. So my whole life has known John Glenn in it. Right? It wasn't history to me. He was making history while I was alive, while we were alive. Yeah. I'm fascinated with a friend of mine who came to me and I said, yeah, I'm going to interview you. He was really excited that I was going to interview. He's like, ask him a question. I was like, what question do you want me to ask him? And he's like, ask him about the bogey at 10 o'clock that John Glenn called to Houston. And so I guess John was in space or at some point and saw a bogey at his 10 o'clock. There's a recording of it. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know the necessarily being a bogey at 10 o'clock, but I do know there's a famous episode while he was orbiting the Earth. And it's covered a little more dramatically, I think, than it happened in real life in the movie The Right Stuff. But he saw these little particles of light when he was over the Earth. And at the time, people didn't really know what they were. And there was speculation that, they were little forms of light. They were little microbes, life in space. This is proof there's life in space. But I think it turned out in reality that it was just ice melting and the lights hitting the ice at a certain angle. And it looked like what he called fireflies. They were, I think, like yellowish orange. And he called them fireflies. And so that whole sparked up a discussion among people that it was life in space. And I think there was also concern that it may have been fuel was leaking or something like that. But it turned out it was just ice melting in the atmosphere, and the light shining off of, I assume, the sun or maybe the Earth made it look like these little particles were flickering, and they didn't look like drops of water. They looked like what he called fireflies. Mm-hmm. So I think that may be what he's referring to.
Is that, he said, ask that question. I was like, I can do that. I'm your guy. and that's good for the listener, because someone out there's probably listened or heard that same, you know, reference. Like you said, they talk about it in the movie, or they kind of hit on it in the movie, The Right Stuff, right? What a great movie that is, about space and exploration and, you know, his dimes in the capsule when he's trying to get his dimes. He's like, I need my dimes, you know, my space dimes, the little things. It's the little things. Go check that movie out. If you haven't seen that movie, The Right Stuff, it's about, I think it's like 1970s, 1980s, right? That's when it came out,
I think, in 84 or 83. Yeah. And it's about the early years of the NASA missions, the Mercury missions, which were really from about 1959 to about 1965-ish is when the book and the movie are covered.
Now, as an author, okay, we haven't really talked too much about like where you've come from, right? So what was it that made you want to focus on, say, the Super Bowl Monday style of writing, or this book right here, The Wingman, where you're going to bring the story of these two gentlemen, comrades, Americans together in a book for us to enjoy? What was that? What path were you in school where you're like, I'm going to be a writer? Can you tell me that, like high school or something?
Yeah, I've always been like a sports nut since when I was a little kid. And I think in the early days, I remember writing like in English class while everyone else was writing essays on, you know, movies they liked or things about their lives. Or I was always writing about sports. And I remember I wrote one essay, I think in like seventh grade, that my teacher just hated because it was all about a football game that I had recently watched. And so it was just, my background was is storytelling. And I like, always enjoyed storytelling. And you tell a lot of times people, authors hear, or they say, you write what you know. And I know sports. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I got into writing. I was an English major in college, and I went to graduate school in professional writing and journalism. And so I developed those skills. I think I'm a pretty decent storyteller. And like I said, you know, a lot of times it turns out you write what you know. And for several years, I wrote sports books, and they were successful, and I really enjoyed doing them. But what I came to realize after a while was two things. One, it's always hard to write a book about individuals if they're famous, because other people have written to death about them. Mm-hmm. John Glenn, or in my earlier books, I wrote a book that's largely about Arnold Palmer, the famous golfer. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book about Joe Montana, the famous quarterback. And if you're going to do books like that on famous people, a lot of the times you have to take a new approach, like a new angle. And you don't tell their whole biography, because there's biographies about everybody. Biography about Franklin Roosevelt or Elvis Presley or Elon Musk. There's all those biographies that tell from the day they were born to the day they died. And if you want to write about those to get it people's attention and have the publisher buy it, a lot of the times you have to sort of zero in on a certain aspect of their life. And all my books have kind of done that. I did a golf book that focused on this sort of late period in Arnold Palmer's career. This book on Joe Montana was focused on this middle part of his NFL career, and a part that's not often remembered. And then with this book, with Super Bowl Monday, it was the same. It was like that I focused on a very particular part of one Super Bowl and all the people who were made that Super Bowl famous. So that was like a bunch of mini biographies that focused in on one specific part of all those famous players' career. So the thing with The Wingmen about John Glenn and Ted Williams is both of them have autobiographies. Both of them have multiple biographies written about them. Both of them have had thousands of magazine and newspaper
baseball cards written about
them. Exactly. They've been covered to death. And if you want to tell a story like that, you have to have sort of a unique angle that, like I said, sort of magnifies one small part of their life and expands it into a larger story. And that's what I did with this book. Was I zeroed in on this friendship between the two and what that was about, how it came to be, how it ebbed and flowed, and how it, what the, you know, heartfelt moments of it were. But it also let me tell the larger story of the readers of, you know, who were these people and what relevant stories helped shape their worldview at that time. That's kind of what I've learned along the way. And I guess I'm always zeroed in on people more than plots. I think readers, and not just readers, but people watch TV and watch movies, the plot's important, absolutely, but the characters is what people care about more. It's why we see so many like reboots of movies or sequels, because people don't want new characters. They want the same characters doing different things.
Right. They want to see like them go.
And so that's,
yeah, you're totally right.
That's what happened with this John Glenn and Ted Williams book, was sort of like, these were familiar people to, they were familiar people to the general public, but not many people know this side of their story. I would hazard that very few people, even if they were big Ted Williams fan, knew anything about his military career.
No.
And much less about his friendship with John Glenn. And John Glenn, most people know, oh yeah, he's that senator who was also an astronaut. They don't know a lot of these stories. So that's sort of how I got to this.
Well, I didn't know John Glenn was involved in the Chinese Civil War.
Well, yeah, he sort of patrolled the skies over China during these parts in the late 40s, until eventually they were pushed further and further out of China.
And the fact is that he had already done everything he needed to do as a person in World War II, like committing himself to the service and fighting and risking everything for good versus evil.
I'm not sure there are many people in the history of the United States who gave back more to their country than John Glenn. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying he's the only one. I'm saying he's on that Mount Rushmore, I think, of people who served their country. Mm-hmm. John Glenn would have to be in the discussion for one of the most central in that. From, you know, the time he joined the Army Air Corps, and then they didn't call him back, so he went 2 weeks later to a Navy recruitment station. From the time he joined the Navy in early 1942 to the day he died in 2016, I think he was giving back to his country, whether it was as a fighter pilot, as a test pilot, as an astronaut, as a senator, as a humanitarian, as a statesman, as a politician in general. I think that he was a man who believed in public service.
Yeah, him, you know, Gerald Ford, you know, these guys that just continue to selflessly serve through the end, the bitter end, the Boy Scout through and through. Was he, do you know, was John Glenn in the Boy Scouts at all? Do you know that?
Gosh, I think so. I think so.
I always like to say that our Boy Scouts kicked Germans' Boy Scouts' ass in World War II. That's how it goes right there. These young men, you know, in the early 30s, growing up to be those trying to get in at 15, 16 years old, bro.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they also were hardened by the Depression. John Glenn was a child with the Depression. He was 8 years old when the Depression hit, and it really hurt his family. His family very much thought they were going to lose their house in the 30s. And I think what he said years later was that became one of the reasons he became a Democrat was that he believed that Franklin Roosevelt had helped pull this country out of the Depression. And
the Green Deal and everything.
It really saved his family. Mm-hmm. So, again, I just I try not to necessarily, you know, say how great people were when I'm doing a book about them, that I don't want to sound like a cheerleader for them, because John Glenn had his flaws. He certainly had his flaws and his warts. He was but I think America would benefit if there were 10 or 15 more John Glenns in the federal government.
Yeah, you know, really, that had that same kind of like, let's just do the right thing.
Yeah, I think he put policy. He believed in the United States, not Democrat, Republican, or any of those kinds of issues. I think he always did what was best.
I get a lot of big dogs on here that have a lot of stars on their shoulders that I talk to, and I ask them, you know, you transition from like one president to another, right? As the chief or of staff, et cetera. It's like, how'd you do that? And they usually come back to me like this. Rad, it doesn't matter my political affiliation because it says U.S. Army, U.S. Marine, U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Navy on our stuff in the military. So we understand what we're doing because it's the U.S. That's what he said. And I think John Glenn probably had that same taste. You know, it's like the U.S., right? What's better?
Yeah.
What's the best for the U.S.? Not my pocketbook.
You know what? I think you're absolutely right. And as I say in the book, John Glenn, I think, was a tremendous statesman. Mm-hmm. He was great as a senator and a figure for America. He wasn't a particularly great politician. It's one of the reasons why I don't think he ever really got close to being president. And he was a World War II and a Korean War astronaut hero. That's, I think, one of the reasons it helped get him elected four times as a senator. But I think that was one of the reasons why he wasn't a great politician, was because he didn't always play partisan politics. He believed in the United States, and there were things he was willing to work for if he thought it benefited the country instead of benefiting the Democrats or this committee or his own personal political aspirations.
Right. Right. He's willing to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's was almost always the case with John Glenn.
Yes. And I love that. And I'm not trying to put him in some type, but he would be on my Mount Rushmore of, I would say, selfless Americans. For sure. Now that we have a Mount Rushmore in our brains of who that would be. And I want my listener to think, who would you put on a Mount Rushmore of selfless Americans? You know, I also want to say like John McCain, Marine Corps Navy pilot, POW, selflessly served, tried to become president, always just tried to do the right thing, you know, just selflessly served. Now, aside from the politics, now let's get back to baseball. Sound good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Ted Williams lived a long life, but he lived kind of like an extravagant lifestyle, didn't he, as his later years in life?
I wouldn't say he lived an extravagant lifestyle. I know if you're
what word am I trying to think about here?
Maybe his untimely demise, is the troubles at the end of his life.
Yeah.
I don't really think that had anything to do with finances. I don't think he lived
eclectic.
High off the hog.
Is that the word I'm looking for? Is it eclectic? Is that the word? Was he eclectic? Isn't he still like in cryostasis?
Yeah. So that was an unfortunate episode that I think had to do with, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, when he died, his body was frozen because two of his children believed that maybe one day he could be reanimated and brought back to life. And it's, frankly, it's not something I really wanted to cover in the book because it's not relevant to the Ted Williams, sure, John Glenn friendship, except for the fact that the third child, the oldest child of the family, was very much against this. And one of the people she publicly lobbied to come help her in her quest to stop this was John Glenn.
Oh.
She said, you know, John Glenn, she went on TV and she said, John Glenn, my daddy was your wingman during the Korean War. He needs you to be his wingman now and stop this cryogenic freezing business.
Yeah.
And it was a very ugly family dirty laundry being aired through the public. And my take on it has always been there was some deception and some uneasiness about what exactly was the truth. But I think part of it had to do with Ted Williams did not have a very good relationship with his children for the most part of their lives in his life. He had three wives who he all divorced, and he wasn't the stay-at-home dad who was always there for his children. And I think part of it, he probably had some guilt over how things went towards the end of his life. And his children sort of persuaded him, two of his children sort of persuaded him to do this cryogenic freezing, that they were going to be frozen too, so that someday maybe we could all be brought back to life and together. And that was one of the interpretations one of his friends and doctors at the time told me. It was basically like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Maybe we will come back together and we can have a good life together, even though we didn't have a great life for the past 30 or 40 years. But it was a sort of hopeful, maybe one day we can all come back thing. And again, it was, as I've said in the book, I think it's a sad ending that it all happened, but it's even worse that it was all happening through the media and the newspapers and tabloids, and people were making crude jokes about the Ted Williams frozen head and things like that. It's just a kind of an ugly thing. I went to dinner with a friend of Ted Williams when I was writing the book. He was a very nice guy. He's an older gentleman. He was a very high-ranking general in the Marine Corps, actually. He was friends with Ted Williams, and he was a huge baseball fan, and he was very, very kind and grateful. A great help to me on the book, and I appreciated him so much. And we went to dinner, and he knew the owner of the restaurant. And he said, hey, let's say hi to the owner. I know him. I'll tell him about you. Tell him what you're doing. And we shook the owner's hand, and I said, oh, it was very nice to meet you. And he said to him, well, this is my friend Adam. He's writing a book on Ted Williams and John Glenn, and they're heroes of mine, and I'm helping him out. And the owner of the restaurant, the first thing he just said was, did they really freeze his head?
Yeah.
And I was like, I felt horrible because Ted Williams' friend was like right there. But it was also like that kind of summed up how a lot of people remember Ted Williams.
Right.
And it's a shame to me, given not just his baseball career, but the fact that he served in two wars, one of which he flew 39 combat missions over communist North Korea.
So, yeah, exactly. 19 years as a baseball player too, I think, right? Yeah. He played like 19 mm-hmm. seasons, right? Yeah. That's, you know, spring training, you know, I get it. You know, he's got a good old cigar in his mouth. He's a pro athlete.
Yeah.
Okay. When I was young and I was 16, I had aspirations of professional baseball. I wanted to be a pro ball. I could play. I could hit the ball. I hit fastballs. That's the life that you think of. So, you know, get at it. Holy cow. Now they got the Dodgers are paying $700 million to their players. Yeah. Holy cow. But he did crack one out of the park yesterday. But geez, where's that money?
Ted Williams was making about $100,000 a year, which was outrageous. A lot of people back then. Yeah.
So much money for a ball player to make. And, you know, like that's big money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the worst part is, I mean, it all gets passed down to the fans who have to now buy $17 beers and $180 tickets and $65 for parking. It's all kind of out of whack.
How does the kid from Sandlot try to get in to watch his favorite player, peek through the fence to try to see the Cubs play or something, you know, or someone at the green wall has a hole he can look through in Boston, you know? I love baseball. When you were coming on and when you're introduced, it's like, it's baseball season, Rad. We should have Adam on. I was like, boom, let's go, dude. I love it. And so as a sports writer, are you writing about baseball?
My next book is not about baseball, no. I'm going to... I keep that under wraps, what the next book's about, because it hasn't quite gotten off the ground yet.
Okay.
Use a military aviation front. But I, you know what? I do foresee another baseball book down the road.
Nice.
It's or another definitely another sports book, but another baseball book is certainly a possibility, especially since, you know, even with this book, you know, baseball is kind of romanticized more than I think any other American sport. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like I'll come back to it. Even in this book, there's really only like 15 pages of baseball in it. Mm-hmm. But I loved writing those pages, covering the history, what Ted Williams did, and particularly one year where he was 39 years old and he led the league in batting. I foresee eventually coming back to baseball.
Yeah, he had like a 400 batting average, I think. He had like a three yeah. something.
He's the last man to hit 400. He had 406 mm-hmm. in 1941. And then 16 years later, at the age of 39, he almost hit 400 again. He hit 388. So that's one of the reasons why people...
What do you think the average fastball speed was then? I'm just curious what you think.
Well, you know, I don't think it was 100. No. I think it was probably mid-90s.
Yeah.
I think someone said, I'm a big fan of the Ken Burns baseball series that was on PBS in the 90s. I think someone said back then that it's not how fast the pitchers are relative from one era to the next. It's more who is the fastest of each era. And I think if you put Ted Williams in today's playing, not if you transported him using a time machine, but right. if Ted Williams grew up in this age, I think he would still be the best hitter in baseball. If he had worked, you know, he had trained 365 days a year sure. instead of spend 4 months fishing in Florida and in the offseason. If he was had access to, you know, the kind of weight training programs they have today, if he had access to batting cages and all those things, I think Ted Williams would still be the best hitter in baseball.
Right, exactly. If Randy Johnson was who he had to face off, he'd be trained to probably face off against Randy Johnson, right? Yeah. You know, simple as that. That, you know, you're surrounded by what you got to train against. I get that 100%, yes. right? And then it just evolves. You know, we just get more and more sports doctors that say, hey, work your tendon mm-hmm. this way, you know, and just yeah. more science involved in, you know, then there's Moneyball. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, we just trade you, Pena. Wait, what? Yeah, just get on base. Love that movie, bro. I just have to say, I know it's just baseball. It's just a different take. It's a different angle. And I love yeah. that. I look forward to anything you write. And I'm going to tell you, are you looking at like transitioning this into some type of like movie or TV show?
Well, if I had the power or authority to do that, sure. I have not heard anything on that front yet. It is. I mean, I do think it's kind of a story that lends itself to a Hollywood screenplay, yes. Hollywood, you know, I think.
Adaptation. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, I said this before, because they're from Boston, Ted Williams was the Boston baseball history example. I feel like Ted Williams and John Glenn should be played by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Oh.
But so maybe one day, maybe they'll come across this and option it. I do think you know, it's the kind of story that, you know, friendship and politics and war and space, I think it lends itself to that. I do know that I feel like if it became a movie, I would watch it with my teeth grit the entire time because they Hollywooded it, you know, it changed this fact,
oh, sure.
changed this neck. But I guess if I saw my name on the big screen and as adapted from Adam Lazarus books, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, I think so too. It'd be cool if it was a series too, because check it, you could follow along different episodes and then yeah. it could keep going along. And then they, you know, today's day and age, everybody can just binge the 8 or 10, 12 episodes in one night.
Yep.
But still, I think that would be kind of cool because then you see, you know, like you said, you see the characters doing other things
yeah.
continually. Yeah, that'd be cool. I think anything that you write, you seem like you have just a really cool demeanor and just you respond really well. And I think that you probably write just as well. So it'd be cool to watch any of your movies, bro, or read any of your books.
I agree with you. Let's get Peacock and Paramount Plus and Netflix all on board with that.
Agreed. Yes. And so to yeah. my favorite executives at those places that watch this, you know what mm-hmm. to do now, okay? Just give him a call or just hit me up, yeah. text me. It's cool.
Yeah.
No Let's problem. Yeah, I'll be in mission control. Don't worry about the braids in my beard. It's totally period for
yeah,
the
that's,
time.
You know what? I have been asked by people if, you know, should be a movie, or have you heard anything about it being a movie? And I always tell them what I told you, but then I add, but like, if it is a movie, I want to be the like pilot number 7 in the background of some like meeting, you know, some officer's mess or officer club like scene where they're partying. I just want to be in the background as an officer, like drinking a beer or something. That's all I want.
You've seen the movie Top Gun?
Yeah.
You know, the part where he goes to meet Charlie in the bar and like, she's like, I'm waiting for a friend. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed a guy who was at Top Gun, who was a part of the movie of Top Gun. And he told me in that scene, the guy that she's waiting for is actually the Top Gun instructor of Top Gun.
Oh, really?
Yes. And which is like, I'm waiting for my friends over here. And she goes and sits down with the guy and he's like, oh man, I'm getting dissed. You know,
you gotta reward someone with something like that.
That's the cameo, dude. That's the cameo of him.
I guess I could be someone in the background of a scene where John Glenn's funeral is going on.
Look at Tarantino's in all his flicks, you know, in some way or somehow.
Yeah, whether, that's true.
You know, he knows how to make a cup of coffee. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know,
that's my one bargaining point. I'll take $1 for the ride. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I love it. I love it. And you should have that in your write up. It's like, look, I'm in it as pilot number 7, and pilot number 7 lives, by the way.
Or I could crash land and be a heroic ending.
Oh man, I went out for this movie and it was John the Baptist was the character, and I said, I'm cool with getting my head cut off and served on a platter. Do you know how many people would realize that was me?
Yeah. There you go.
It's like, all right. No, that's great. So you got a book coming out? There's something else, and you're not going to drop that right now on the show. I don't get that.
No. I'm in the very, very early stages of thinking about another book. It's part superstition, part embarrassment that I don't really like to talk about it until it's a little further down the road. But again, without going into details, I think I've started to realize that I think people like characters more than plot. And then I'm getting kind of, you know, whatever they call it, inside baseball in this. But I really think that's true. It's like, why do they make 15 Marvel movies? Because people want to see Captain America again.
Yeah.
Why did they bring back Top Gun? People wanted to see Goose and Maverick again.
Yeah.
You know, and I think
Back to the Future is another one. You know, it's like everybody wants to see Marty McFly keep going through.
Exactly. That's why they made it into a Broadway show, I think. People don't necessarily want to hear about new people. They want to hear about people they're familiar with. And Ted Williams or Arnold Palmer or whoever, whatever person in history, if I was to do a book on Elvis, again, I'm not doing a book on Elvis, but if I was doing a book on Elvis and, you know, maybe the whole story behind his famous Hawaii comeback show in 1968, like that could be a book because people, it's Elvis, you know, I don't know this chapter about Elvis's story. That's very interesting to me. Everybody knows some of the background and, you know, the movies he made and things like that and him dying and all those things.
Well, you're right, because I mean, just seeing this last movie that was about Elvis, I didn't know that he was under the thumb of the colonel the whole
time. That's kind of was part of the original take on it, I think. I think people want to sort of latch on to history they know, but learn things they don't know, which is a weird, like, kind of a paradox, but it's true, because nobody knows. Like, you could name the most famous person in American history, George Washington, like Hamilton. Just think about the play Hamilton,
exactly.
The Broadway show Hamilton. Like, people knew he was $10 on the $10 bill and one of the founding fathers and all these things, but nobody knew all these things that were prominent in the biography and then the movie Hamilton, the play Hamilton. I think people want to hear about characters they're familiar with, but learn new things. And I think The Wingman is an example of that.
And what's funny about that mention about Hamilton, real quick, just to piggyback, is my 15, 16-year-old daughter at the time was just obsessed with all of the soundtrack. And so here she is. She could tell me all about Hamilton. She's like, oh no, let me tell you all about Hamilton. I was like, oh, just put it in a song and you'll know your math.
That's funny because, my wife got big into Hamilton, and I hope she's not going to watch this because
she is.
She is like, she has like the lowest threshold for history. Like, she could listen to like 30 seconds of all my book ideas. before she's like, that's too much history, I'm not interested. But she loves Hamilton and is for months was asking me all these questions about the Revolutionary War and Washington and who's James Madison. And like, and now my kids are the same way. And my one son is really into Hamilton and he became really interested in the history of American presidents after that. And he's fascinated, which strangely enough, he's more fascinated by the ones who were assassinated. But that's just how it is. And I think,
but what was it? He's maybe a detective in the making. I don't know, bro.
I think it was because Hamilton was kind of assassinated.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, but,
and Lincoln and Kennedy.
Yeah. So, there's people, we need to learn history. Obviously it's important. There's that whole, if you don't learn your history, you're doomed to repeat it, but you don't have to get it by picking up a ninth grade textbook either.
Right. Right. No, I get that. Yeah, because sometimes that's hard to read.
or just boring.
I'm playing. No, I loved history at school. I went to the school where there was no emails, man, and there was no one tracking me like that today. Now we got it all on our phones. Yeah. It's like you didn't turn your assignment in. Yeah. Back then, I was like, oh, I turned everything in.
Yeah.
For the day. Man, oh, man. So what year did you come to this earth?
82.
All right. Yeah. See, I'm just 5 years older than you. So listen to the future. Let me tell you what's up. Grow your braids out.
Yeah. In those 5 years, you learned a lot more than I did.
Oh, in those 5 years, I just learned that it's always front foot forward.
Okay.
Just keep going. Just keep hacking. And when you get like writer's block, go outside and get some fresh air and go for a walk and enjoy some nature and just come down from whatever, has just blocked you. And it might just come to you just when you don't expect it. Like I get hit up by people like, hey, Rad, I have a book. You'd be surprised how many times I get that. How do I get it published? Right. How do I get how do I get in the space? I have ideas. It's like, well, it's not so easy. Publishers already have writers that do certain space. And so they rely on writers to write that space. So if you can come in like what you're suggesting and take a different spin on it, or, you know, what would you give somebody out there right now, like maybe two pieces of advice that have ideas that would like to see it happen? What steps should they take?
I get asked a lot of that, questions like that. And I will preface this by saying, this is what works for me. And obviously what I say or pick whatever famous writer, their advice may not work for everybody. But my first piece of advice is always, if you want to be a writer, then you need to write. And by that, I mean, like, I have a lot of people who tell me they're sort of overwhelmed by like the blank page, or they don't know where to begin. Or, you know, I'm sure there's some people who are just worried about like embarrassing themselves or the fear of rejection.
Right.
The only way to get better at writing is by writing. Like whatever you're thinking about writing, your life story, a poem, your favorite recipe for banana pudding, like write it down, get it down on paper, and then, you know, spend the next week rewriting it and start over, or scratch out half of it, and rearrange it and cut it up with the, you know, the red pen like we used to use in grade school. The only way you're going to get better at that is to do it. Like, even if it sucks, like that's your 1.0. Start over. Like, you're not going to write by thinking about it and, you know, worrying about it. You have to actually do it. And even if it's just like your brain pouring out onto paper or onto the computer screen, that's the only way to get started. And then you just keep polishing. That's the word I use a lot. It's like polishing it, polishing and polishing. So that's probably the first advice. And I do think what I said earlier is also a really good start for people who, whether they're like 4 years old or whether they're a high school senior or whether they're like my grandfather, who had retired in the he'd retired in the early 80s and then decided in the mid 90s he wanted to write a novel.
Right.
Write what you know. So you don't have to, your whole career doesn't have to be, you know, if you were an accountant, your whole career doesn't have to be writing about the history of accountants or a murder mystery starring an accountant. But it's a good place to start. Like, write what you know. If you're a baseball fan, write a baseball book. If you love poetry, you know, nature poetry, go out and write poems about a beautiful park or something like that. I mean, poetry is not my thing, for the record, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, whatever you're passionate about. I've always been passionate about sports. It's how I sort of got to the point I am. Your passion will come through when you start writing. So that's why the whole write what you know, like, you're usually passionate about things, you know. So that's the other piece of advice I would give, is like, you're just starting, write what you know. Like my, I'm thinking about my grandfather who wrote a novel at age 81, I think, was very interested in like finance and stuff like that. And his novel was a lot about, I think it was like about the stock market and things like that. So he wrote what he knew. And that's always a good place to start.
And it leaves kind of like a little bit of a legacy for you, you know, that they can say, hey, this is what grandpa wrote. You know, this is what we have, this book. It's been passed down through 13 generations and, you know, keep it safe. You know, grandpa's writings, you know, or your writings or your kids' writings or heaven, you know, like, you know, who I think is our Shakespeare of the day. And it's no offense to all the authors, it's Taylor Swift. So I think that she is our Shakespeare. Where it, she's written all of her stuff. She writes it out there. She puts it out there. She's willing to take the rejections. She's really willing to take the ridicule. She's willing to take the success. But at the end of the day, like you said, write about something you're passionate about. And if you listen to a lot of what she writes about, it's a lot of songs that are all about relationships and life. And so she seems to be passionate about it and she's very successful. You're passionate about sports yourself. Yes, I just put you in the same realms as Taylor Swift. Okay. And so you are successful because you believe in it. You're putting it out there. You're following through with what you've been taught and also what you've had to learn on your own. You may have gone to school and there are people who are book smart, but can you put your book smart from saying, say, becoming an entrepreneur, actually doing it? And so here you're taking, hey, this is how you like indent the first paragraph, bro. Indent. Okay. Capitalize the first letter.
I mean, there are some things. You only learn by, it's kind of what I was saying, is that you only learn by doing. Yes. Like, it's great to have education, like traditional educational background, but it's going to, you have to apply it in the real world. I was watching, I'm a big Law and Order fan, and there was one Law and Order where they were talking about something, and one of the attorneys was saying how they didn't learn this kind of stuff wasn't taught in law school. And professor said something like, that's because it's a law school, not a lawyer school.
Right.
It's like you learn the law, but you don't learn how to be a lawyer. Like that's becoming a lawyer. You learn on the job and going through experience and practicing maybe like, I don't know, mock trials or whatever. Right. But like, and you really only learn by being in the courtroom in a real world situation. Same thing with really most anything. And it's the same thing with writing is no one's going to teach you how to write. They may give you tools for, you know, storytelling and the basics of like grammar and spelling and all those things. But they may give you tools for character development and plot twists or whatever. But the only way you're going to ever get to where you want to be in that kind of field is by doing it and you being your best teacher.
Pursuing it until you die. Just keep going. Just keep at it. Don't stop. Like you said, your father or your grandfather was 81. Today, we have presidents that are running at 80 years old. Okay. So if you're 60, you still got 20 years of job left in you, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know who that is I'm talking to, but get it done already. All right. It's not going to clean itself. Okay. All right. Now,
I think we could use I think we could just for the record, not Democratic or Republican, probably could use like a 47-year-old.
You know, and one that spoke another language fluently or something, like, you know, even Spanish, like just hola. Like, how you guys doing? Like, I agree with you 100%. And I know I've had you for almost an hour of time, and I feel like I could keep talking to you for a long time. And I know you're very busy, and there's a lot of people that want your time. So thank you for giving that to us today. Thank you to your wife. Thank you to your kids for supporting you and being there for you and always listening to you, whether you know it or not. And, you know, your Wingman, the Wingman, the book, the Wingman, when does that come out? Has that already launched, or am I just getting...
It came out in the fall. I would just say anybody who wants to buy it or read more about it or see some of the reviews or some other interviews I've done along the way, some other podcasts and newspaper write-ups, just go to my website. Just adamlazarusbooks.com, L-A-Z-A-R-U-S, adamlazarusbooks.com. There's a lot there about this book and all my other books. And there's even, I believe, a couple like audiobook chapter samples. So you can, before you buy that.
Do you do your Audible? Do you do your voiceover?
No, I haven't, which part of me wants to be like the next book I do. Like, yeah, I probably do want to read it. Except I feel like I would be so self-conscious the entire 9 hours of it. But B, I also think somewhere along the line, someone's going to be like, you're a bad book reader. You shouldn't be doing this. And hopefully it would be like, someone in the production team, like before the book comes out and not after it comes out. But yeah, I think while that would be fun, I don't think I don't think that's in my future.
Usually the people that say that about someone who reads a book for you is because they didn't get to do it. They usually have.
I usually think,
you know, the ones that are like, oh, this dude's too fast, or this dude's could have done better.
That would be a whole nother problem. Yeah. I'm going to watch when you post this, I'll watch it and I'll just cringe every time I'm talking.
Don't cringe, bro.
Stop.
No, look, we're together. It's okay. You're great. I just told you you're awesome. I just put you in Taylor Swift's category.
That's true. You are the second person to mention Taylor Swift to me in a podcast like this.
Okay.
You know, the books about John Glenn and Ted Williams.
Yes.
And someone said something to me like, tell us about this John Glenn, Ted Williams friendship connection. Is it like Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce?
But they're like together.
Yeah, I know. But I guess they were sort of just saying it was more like two massive celebrities from two different worlds.
Uh-huh.
And I guess that's apt. You know, it is kind of apt.
Sure.
But it was just funny to me. And I was like, oh, I should have piggybacked on that. I'm sure someone's writing a Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce split bio right now. So good luck to them.
Well, she is the man. So she gets to get talked about in everybody's podcasts. All right. So,
that's true.
Including ours.
You made your quota today.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to go take a break now.
You're going to get that. You'll get the extra check mark on your, social media profile
in heaven, bro. I'm looking for heaven here. I need the check mark in heaven when I get there with,
yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure Taylor Swift has that kind of power. Maybe in a couple of years.
Oh, you're great, bro. You're great. Look, I hope we can get your book into our book club, our Soft Rep book club. You heard me drop that in the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
And we do have a book club, and the guy's Brandon Webb. He's the author of Steel Fear and Cold Fear, and he also runs the website, softrep.com. He's a former Navy SEAL sniper instructor, and so he transitioned into an author and writing, and he kind of had the same thing. He's like, you just got to do it. You just got to, you know, put it on paper.
Yeah. And if anybody gets the book for your book club or anyone listening now, and you want me to sign it or dedicate it, my email address is on the website. Just go there and I'm happy
and
to do
it. And that's adamlazarus.com, right?
Books. AdamLazarusBooks.com.
AdamLazarusBooks.com. And what we'll do is my producer, Anton, he'll listen, and the guys, Mark and them, they'll dissertate everything down below on the website, and there'll be hyperlinks. So I trust in them to just link to your website. And then if my listener or viewer wants to know more, go check out softrep.com or wherever you're watching it. Leave a comment down below. I've had Adam's time for almost a solid hour. We've really enjoyed you being here. You're welcome back with any endeavor that you want to bring to us and to our community. Welcome to the Soft Rep community, and congratulations on your transition. And I just want to say, on behalf of everybody here at Soft Rep, on behalf of Adam Lazarus and myself, this is Rad saying thank you and peace.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.